You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to our SmartCast microlearning podcast series titled Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in NAMD and DME to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes, an expansion of the Vision Relief No Eyes Left Behind initiative. This series is hosted by Dr. David Eichenbaum, a collaborative associate professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at the University of South Florida Morsani College of Medicine, and director of research at Retina Vitreous Associates of Florida in St. Petersburg. Let's get started with today's episode.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. David Eichenbaum, and I will be the host of today's podcast, Transforming Care Through Next Generation Therapies in Neovascular Macular Degeneration and Diabetic Macular Edema to Lower Burden and Improve Outcomes. This is the last of a four-part podcast talking about unmet needs in the management of NAMD and DME, addressing treatment burden. Today, I'm interviewing my good friend and brilliant colleague, Dr. Sumeet Sharma, retina and uveitis specialist, uveitis fellowship director, and assistant professor of ophthalmology at Cleveland Clinic's Cole Eye Institute. In this episode, we are talking about strategies to successfully transition patients with NAMD or DME from first to next generation anti-VEGF therapies to help address treatment burdens. Sumeet, how are you?
I'm doing great, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Happy to have you. Glad to have you on the line, and always pleased to learn from your expertise and your incredible department at the Cole Eye Institute. So thank you so much for being available and for talking with us. So what I want to talk about today is moving patients from the first generation anti-angiogenic therapies for common retinal disease, the NAMD and DME, and moving patients from the bevacizumab, ranibizumab, and aflibercept 2 milligrams to the aflibercept 8 milligrams and faricimabs. And then we can talk a little bit about what we would do down the line with potential other therapies, but we'll focus on what's commercially available. And how do you identify patients that you would move to treatment with these potentially longer interval dosing and potentially more potent therapies? And as a second part to that question, how do you identify patients you would start on these second generation therapies, the aflibercept 8 or faricimab, if you start patients on second generation therapies?
Yeah, so for the first part, I think, you know, when you're talking to these patients, it can come down to either an inadequate response. So those who, despite every four-week injection, still have fluid, that's a no-brainer, right? That is somebody that if they still have fluid and you're treating them every 4 weeks, well, yeah, we need to switch them because we need to try to get rid of the fluid. We know fluid is not good. It can over time lead to vision loss and over time lead to fibrosis and other complications. And so that's the easy patient. The other ones are, you've got a patient who's on an every 8 week treatment regimen, has been stable for years. Every time you've tried to extend them going more than 8 weeks or whatever your interval happens to be, they get a little bit of fluid that comes back. That's another one that if the patient is interested in trying to extend their duration in between, it makes a lot of sense too. So those are kind of the two easy ones. So either an incomplete response despite every 4 week injection or a patient who just wants to try to go longer in between. The challenge comes into the other ones, the patient that's out at 12 weeks but still has a big PED. Would they benefit from a switch? And I've had a few patients where I've done that, where I've switched them, and all of a sudden their PEDs start to flatten out, their vision gets a little bit better, they get a few more weeks in between. I think it's often worthwhile to consider it in patients who've even been stable for a long time. If their vision isn't ideal or you see other factors on their imaging that defines them as not being a complete responder beyond just having fluid.
So let's go back on this notion of incomplete responders or non-responders. Two-part question here. Do you think anyone with NAMD is a non-responder, a complete non-responder to anti-VEGFs if they really have an accurate diagnosis of NAMD?
So I don't think a complete non-responder, if it's an accurate diagnosis, right? Often if you bring these patients back at a week or two after their last injection, which I don't have very, very many of that, maybe one or two patients total, where at 4 weeks they have lots of fluid, but at 2 weeks you see a big reduction. That's a good way to gauge that, is are they responding and it's just not durable enough? I can think of one patient who, when she gets an injection every 2 weeks pre-faricimab, she would be dry, but at 3 weeks, the fluid started to come back, and at 4 weeks, it looked like you hadn't done anything at all. But I think if you are a true AMD patient, there's very few, if any, where it's not polyploidal, it's not CSR, it's not something else that, or MacTel or something else that you've missed or you haven't thought about. I think there's very few, if any, that are true non-responders in that population.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. I think that if you got one of those masquerading diagnoses, you can see folks who really don't budge a week or two out. But I think 100% of true NAMD patients respond to some extent. But then, of course, you have the inadequate responders, the ones that you and I are talking about who don't respond well enough. And what does that patient look like to you? What's the inadequate NAMD responder?
I mean, it's the stuff that I was just said, right? It's the ones who still have persistent fluid at 4 weeks. It's slowly getting better, but they're not really drying out, or they have a few persistent areas of fluid that just not going away, or you've been at a very stable interval for like 6 weeks and they have fluid come back eventually. That's another one where the disease may be changing over time and becoming more resistant to treatment. And I think it's important to remember that this isn't just one and done. They get a new neovascular event. They can still get new CNV as elsewhere. And so that is another thing that I consider a inadequate response.
Yep, I'd agree with both of those definitions. And I think that's very well put. You have the ones who just don't dry up completely, even at 4 or 5 weeks. Then you have the ones who can't extend at all past 4 or 5 weeks, even to 6 weeks. And those are two different types of folks who are not adequately responding, because neither of those patients is going to persist with Q 4 to 5 week therapy forever on anything. And those are excellent definitions of inadequate responders. What about in DME? In DME, I do believe there are a couple of patients, a small percentage of patients who really don't respond to anti-VEGF monotherapy.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, I like to bucket DME really into thirds, at least in my practice. I get a lot of referrals, so I don't see the direct treatment naive DME as often. But in my practice, I kind of get the third who are just great responders. One or two anti-VEGF almost dries them out. I get a third that are okay responders. They kind of slow down and you reduce the fluid over time. You just got to be persistent with it. And I have about a third of my patients with DME that are just very treatment resistant for just pure anti-VEGF therapy and need something additional.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable way to break it out. And that's what we saw in the DRCR network publications from the 2010s, that there was a proportion of patients, a significant proportion, who didn't dry out enough with anti-VEGF monotherapy. Okay, let's talk about the patients who, in both disease states, who do exhibit some response, but they aren't responding enough to anti-angiogenics. When do you talk to these patients about moving them to the aflibercept 8s or faricimabs of the world? When do you bring that up, or do you start patients on that on these agents these days? Because many, you know, we have many more treatment experienced patients in our clinics than treatment naive patients walking in the door.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to, for neovascular AMD, start with one of the first line agents and see how they do, because it's easy the first visit for me to give bevacizumab and then get an authorization for switching. I think somebody with a mild amount of fluid, I'll treat them and see them in a month and see how they're looking. And if they've had a massive response, I'm probably not going to switch them. I'll get prior authorization of that first visit for the next visit, though. And if they haven't had a great response, I think of switching early. And I will switch even at that first visit if I'm not seeing as dramatic of a response in neovascular AMD as I'd like to see with a single treatment. For DME, it's a little different, but not that different. I kind of look at it kind of as a 2 or 3 injections to see what kind of a treatment response I'm getting. And if it's not a great one, I'm switching to one of the other agents. And usually nowadays, it's going to either 8 milligram of aflibercept or faricimab first in DME. And then if that's not working, then I'll consider steroids in that population.
And some of these patients have their treatment choices mandated through step edits. I'm sure you deal with that, you know, as much as I do. And some patients have step edits, and then they have preferred agents, and then they have physician choice. So it's, you know, it can be basically a double step, which of course is a thorn in my side and something that we advocate against with the American Society of Retina Specialists and the Academy. But we do deal with that in a large number of our managed Medicare and a commercially insured patients. So when you have a patient, we've described the types of patients as far as non-responders that you're switching. If they do go ahead and respond and dry up enough, then do you typically treat and extend them with the second generation agents, similar to what we've done for years with the first generation therapies?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what I usually do. Once they've switched and they've dried up and they're looking good, I will treat and extend them, try to get them to the longest interval possible. And then it becomes really interesting because we have the two different therapies. And where, what do you do if you get them to like 8 weeks? Do you switch them again? And I have done that a few times. And I have had a few that went a little longer, but a few that looked a little worse, so they switched back. But I tend to leave them on the newer generation therapy once they've shown a poorer response to one of the first generation therapies. I haven't had very many that I've switched back, maybe less than a handful, to one of the first generation therapies.
And why would you switch them back to a first generation therapy?
Patient preference for the ones that have had it happen is like, oh, I felt like my vision was better. And I'm just like, okay. That's fine. You get a say in this. And if you felt that was better and you want to come in 6 weeks instead of eight, I'm okay with that. Yeah.
So when you're extending someone on aflibercept 8 or faricimab, do you still do 2 week increments or 1 week increments, or do you do something different with these agents that are tested in the studies, you know, to go by 4 week increments? And the PTI arm and faricimab, they jump by fours, and in the dose regimen modification, the DRMs, they jump down by fours or eights with aflibercept 8.
Yeah, so I don't tend to follow that protocol. I have looked, I kind of try to consider the patient. So have they had a lot of fluid to start with and they had a very slow response? I'm probably going to go by a couple of weeks at a time. If they had a dramatic response in the switch to the new agent and they come back and they look completely dry, I'll consider going up by even up to 4 weeks. When I come down, I tend to go down by less than they did. So I don't jump down by four or eight. I'll jump down a couple of weeks and see how they're looking, as long as it's a small amount of fluid that came back. Now, if they had a massive recurrence, then it might be a bigger jump down. But if it's a small recurrence, it'll just be a couple of weeks at a time. Do you do anything different?
No, you know, for my treatment experienced patients, I treat and extend them just like I would for the first generation agents, because like you, I'm either switching the ones that are tough to treat or the ones that I couldn't extend. You know, the other bucket of switchers for me are ones who I couldn't get past 8 or 10 or even 12 weeks, and then I switch them and then I extend them. But I do all of those by 2 week increments. The ones I'm doing by 4 week increments are treatment naive patients, because I kind of try to test drive the study design in the real world a little bit. And I don't go with aflibercept 8, dose, then 16 weeks, but I'll go dose, and then 4, 8, 12, 16, just to see if it works kind of like it does in the clinical trial with the real reduction of burden. And in the treatment-naive patients, I'm getting pretty reasonable success with that, which is exciting and encouraging. From the seat of my pants, I think both faricimab and aflibercept 8 in treatment-naive patients can extend longer and stronger. At least I feel like I have evidence supporting extension longer and stronger than I did with Rani 0.5 or aflibercept 2 when I was using those more. The other ones that I'll extend by bigger increments are patients who've been super stable and just remained on Q12 or 16-week maintenance therapy with like aflibercept 2. I say, you know, we can switch you to aflibercept 8, and then I can just add 4 weeks to your number. And I've done that a handful of times because some of those patients just fatigue about coming in and they forget why they're there. And they're like, what are we doing again, doc? And
oh, absolutely.
You know, do you have patients like that? I'm sure you do.
We share some of those patients, I'm sure, because we send them back and forth.
We do. I mean, they like us, so they come in and they take the shots, but they can't really, you know, they don't know after, you know, 5-7 years of treatment why they're getting a shot every 12 weeks. Do you ever stop patients, or do you often stop patients, or do you put them on some kind of long duration maintenance therapy?
So my approach with the first generation agents had been that if you could get out past 16 weeks and you can do it a couple times in a row, I would offer it to you after if you'd been on therapy for years and see what you think. And it's amazing the number of patients that are like, you know what? I don't want to take the risk. 3 shots a year. I'll see you in 16 weeks. But there's a few where you do. And it's been mixed. I've had about probably half and half. Half the patients haven't recurred or haven't come back in at least, but I've been seeing them and I'm not seeing fluid. And then the other half that it eventually 9 months, a year later, some fluid comes back. And I basically tell them, if you've had that happen once where the fluids come back, you're going to get treatment forever, but we'll try to get you back to that 16 weeks in between.
Yep. I have a very similar approach. I do offer it to them. I do tell them if I'm stopping therapy, I got to see you more often. I say, I can't stop and I keep seeing you every 60 weeks as if we can stop, but I got to see you every, 4 to 6 weeks for the next 6 months just to make sure this isn't coming back or something like that. And they often don't want to do that. They'd rather just see me, 3 or 4 times a year. With the second generation agents, with the aflibercept 8s and the furosemides, I feel confident that I can take those 12 weakers and make them 16 weakers most of the time. I mean, could I do it with the first generation agents? Possibly, but I feel like I have evidence supporting me with the second generation agents to really make them 16 or even 20 weakers and just see them a handful of times a year, which I think is very doable for patients.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the duration of extension in the second generation agents is more like you need to get out to 20 to 24 weeks before I'll consider stopping. And at that point, they're like, what, 2 a year? And then that's not a big deal. I'd rather do that than see you every 8 to 12 weeks to make sure there's no fluid coming back. Now, where that may change, though, in the future is if HOMO-CT really takes off and I can do that and say, okay, come in when there's fluid, just get scanned every day and we'll have you in. And I do think that'll change things for us quite a bit. And I'm hopeful in the positive direction. So we'll see how that goes.
It's super cool. And I love the potential of HOMO-CT. The things that worry me are compliance and cost, because I'm not going to know when those patients quit using their HOMO-CT. Necessarily.
No, you are, because we're going to get a report if they haven't. Part of the setup is if they haven't done a scan once a month, we get a report on those to call them and schedule them for an appointment.
So that would be good. I've been using the HOMO-CT in the Regenex series, and I love it. I love the program. But those clinical trial patients, are closely monitored coming in. But if we will get a report when they're not using it in the commercial product, that would be really. And someone checks that report, meaning you or me or someone we know and trust.
It's going to come in as an alert as if they had had an event. It's going to be the same thing. If they haven't done a scan in 30 days, we'll get that same event notification.
Kind of like the 4C home, because I do think there's a lot of revolutionary potential in the HOMO-CT for active disease.
Absolutely. I mean, we can say, get your first injection, see you in a week with the OCT, and then decide when you need to come in.
Yep. I think people will really love that, especially as we get to even longer duration therapies. Here, you and I are talking about aflibercept 8 and furosemab 16 to 20 weeks. And we're talking from the podium about gene therapies, tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the port delivery system, all these things that are truly durable. To close out, which of those three, let's say, are you most excited about as the next step after the next generation injections?
Yeah, so I think safety is always top of mind for me and ease of use for the patients too. So probably the TKIs of the three is what's most exciting to me, because I think that there is a clear mechanism that makes sense. The safety so far has been stellar. We haven't really seen any type of autoimmune inflammatory occlusive events, and not even the subtle inflammation events that have been seen with the others. And so that's probably the most exciting to me. And it's easy. No surgery.
I agree. Those are definitely probably, there's definitely the least like sci-fi sexy, but they're definitely the ones that appear the cleanest so far. I appreciate you spending time with me today and talking with me. It's always a pleasure. I look forward to seeing you at Academy. I'm sure we'll cross paths several times in the next 2 weeks. But thank you very much, Sumeet, for being with us here today on the last episode in this series. It's important to be able to understand how to best implement new therapies in order to address patient barriers. We appreciate the time you took to discuss these issues with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure as always.
Thank you for your time. Listen again to the other episodes in this series discussing strategies to reduce the treatment burden and improve outcomes for NAMD and DME. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME essentials. A special thank you to our grant supporter, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity.